I'm very excited to invite the co-founder of Convention Estates Project up here, Mark Meckler. Please, would you, sir?
Thank you. You know, I had a mentor one time when I was first doing a lot of public speaking. A guy by the name of Jim Rohn. If you're old like me, you might remember Jim. Kind of a Zig Ziglar kind of guy. And I was talking to him one night. He used to speak in front of an audience like 10,000, like nothing I've ever done. And so I had a chance to have dinner with him a bunch, and I was on the road with him a bunch. And one night I asked him, you know, have you ever been any place where you went into a room and you were hoping for 5,000 people and maybe there were 50 people or something, and, you know, super disappointing? And he said, oh, yeah, I mean, that's so many times over my career. I can't even count the number of times. You never know. I mean, well, the announcement didn't go out right. The weather was bad. Whatever. Stuff happens, right? And so it's not always what you expect when you walk in a room. And I asked him, well, what do you do? Like, how do you deal with that? And he said, what do I do? Exactly what I would have done if there were 10,000 in the room. And I said, isn't that hard? Like, it's the energy's different. You're expecting 10,000 people. You got a small crowd. Maybe you're disappointed. Maybe there's a financial impact for you. In his case, this is how he earned his living. And he said, look, Mark, when I go out and speak, I'm speaking because of my belief in God. And that's why I'm out on the road. And my job is to reach one person. Like, if I'm speaking to an entire arena full of people, if I can reach one person's heart, then I've done what I'm supposed to do. And I don't know if that one person is one in 10,000 or they're just the one person who showed up that night. So, you know, I'm going to deliver whatever I possibly can. So I've always remembered that when I travel around. Sometimes I'm with grassroots groups and they say, well, we're going to have 20 people and two people show up. And they're really bummed out. The people invited everybody. I'm never bummed out. Like, so my attitude about you being here tonight, what it means to me is you're exactly the people that are supposed to be in the room tonight. That's, I count on God to be in control of that. And then my job is just to speak, hopefully to maybe one of you, hopefully to all of you, but at least one of you. I want to start with a story from American history. You know, I think when we study American history, at least the way I studied it growing up, and maybe it's not particularly good because I grew up in Los Angeles, but when I was growing up and studying American history, and I think this is how we all study it, we study it according to what I call the great person theory of history, the great man or great woman theory of history. We look at a war and we want to know who the general was and what did the general think, or who the president was that took us into that war, got us out of that war. What did they think? What were their motivations? How did they act? When we look back at the American Revolution, we look back at the great men of the American Revolution and we think of Madison and Adams and Jefferson and Franklin and Patrick Henry, the great orator of the American Revolution. Sam Adams, I call him the narrator, the message maker of the American Revolution. We know all those guys because they gave speeches, right? Or they wrote stuff. Or people wrote about them. People painted them. And so these are seminal figures of their times. And we study history by studying them. And then I think we make a major mistake is we think we understand the history. And we don't really understand the history because they were not normal people. They were the unusual people of their times. They were the people, sometimes the people who sought the limelight, sometimes the people who were just incredibly talented. You know, when you talk about Washington, the indispensable man, I mean, he was necessary for the formation of this country, for fighting the Revolutionary War, for being our first president, for being there at convention in 1787. Didn't do anything really, but he was there as the figurehead of that convention. Indispensable. But if all you do is you study George Washington, and I've read a lot of biographies of Washington, and I keep reading biographies of these guys, but you cannot actually understand what happened because he was the indispensable man. He wasn't the regular man. And really, most of history, of all of American history or any history you study, is actually written by regular people who nobody ever writes a book about, who nobody ever takes a picture of or makes a video of or a movie about or writes a play. They didn't give speeches. They weren't standing up at the pulpit and saying impressive things to big congregations. They were just regular people living their lives, and they were willing to step to the front. When the moment came in their life, when the question came, what will I do? What can I do? These are the people who, instead of turning away, leaned in. They leaned into the moment and they did something. And we never will know most of these stories. And I find that difficult, and I think it's somewhat unfortunate, and I seek them out. And many years ago in this movement, somebody told me this story, A lot of you know Rick Green from Patriot Academy. He did not tell me this story. This is one of the rare stories that I taught Rick. And this is really interesting, our relationship. He tells me things I've never heard. I'm so amazed. And it's vice versa because we both read a lot. And this is a story of a captain in the Continental Army by the name of Levi Preston. And for those of you who are Patriot Academy fans, there's going to be a statue of Levi Preston at the Patriot Academy campus in Fredericksburg. Levi Preston was just a regular guy. He was a farmer. He had a family at the time of the Revolutionary War when it broke out, when Lexington and Concord happened. He was 23 years old. Wife, kids, farm. Just a very typical revolutionary guy living in those times in the colonies. And he went out to fight. He was one of the original Minutemen. He was at the battles of Lexington and Concord. And he was there when that famous shot heard around the world was fired. He actually heard that shot. And so if you want to understand the history of the American Revolution, and you can ask a guy like that, you want to. We're really blessed today because we know his story. And the reason we know his story, by the way, you won't find it in any history book. I've never seen it in a book. You can find it online if you look up Levi Preston. And the reason we know it is because there was a young historian by the name of Mellon Chamberlain. And in 1843, Mellon Chamberlain is traveling around the country, still a young country in 1843, if you think about it. He's traveling around, and he's trying to collect the remaining stories from the last living Minutemen. 1843, those guys are pretty old, right? And if you think back then, that's somebody late 80s, early 90s. Now, a lot of us know people that age nowadays. And those people are out golfing. They're sharp as can be. Back then, if you were late 80s, early 90s, we're talking Methuselah old, right? Like, everybody in your town would know, oh, yeah, Captain Preston, yeah, he lives out on the south side of town. He knows everything. He's been around forever, right? So everybody would know him. So Chamberlain is traveling around the country collecting the stories of the last remaining Minutemen. Can't record them. You can only write them down back then. And so he's got his pen and his paper, and he's trying to get to these guys face-to-face before they're all gone. And he finds finds Levi Preston living in North Carolina. And he goes to interview him, and he asks him a series of questions about the cause for the Revolutionary War. Chamberlain's a pretty smart guy, and he thinks he knows what caused the war. He knows kind of the fundamental building blocks of the American Revolution. And so that he sets out to ask those questions, and he asks Captain Preston, when you went out to fight the Redcoats, what did you mean by it? Like, did you go out to fight them because of the Stamp Act? You were frustrated by having to buy those stamps, put them on all your documents. It was really just a tax, and you knew that, and that frustrated you. And Captain Preston said, stamps? Governor Bernard locked the stamps in the armory, and I'm sure I never bought one of them. I don't think anybody did. Okay, so it wasn't the Stamp Act. I mean, we all read about that in school, the Stamp Act, right? And so he thinks, well, maybe it wasn't the Stamp Act. How about the tea tax? You were frustrated by the high tax on British tea. We've all read about that. It was outrageous. It was an injustice in the colony. And Captain Preston says, tea? Son, I was a farmer. We didn't drink any tea. We drank coffee. No tea, no Stamp Act. Okay, so the arguments for the war are falling away. So Chamberlain says, well, maybe it was the revolutionary writers, the men who inspired the revolution. Maybe you were reading Burke and Montesquieu, Paine, and Common Sense. And Preston says, I never heard of those men. We read the Bible, Psalms, the Almanac, some of us, but those men you speak of, I don't know those names. So it's not the writers, it's not the Stamp Act, it's not the tea tax. And you can imagine Mellon Chamberlain, he's a smart guy. He's pretty sure he knows the cause of the American Revolution, and none of what he's asking Preston, none of it appears to have motivated Preston to actually go out and fight that day. And so he goes what I think is kind of goes big, and the big philosophical question. Maybe you were just tired of British tyranny. You were tired of dealing with that. Preston says, tyranny? I didn't feel any tyranny. No tyranny, no tea, no Stamp Act, no revolutionary writers. I think he's confused at this point. And so he says to him, well, I don't understand. When you went out to face those Redcoats that day, what did you mean by it? Preston says, what do we mean? Son, when we went out to face them Redcoats that day, we had always governed ourselves, and we always intended to. And them Redcoats, they intended that we shouldn't. That's it. That's the entire political philosophy of the American Revolution. And you can read Montesquieu, and you can read Burke, and you can read the fiery speeches of Patrick Henry. You can read the biography of Washington or Sam Adams, and you will not find a better, more concise, more precise statement of the political philosophy of the American Revolution than that issued by Captain Levi Preston all those years later. Now, a funny aside on that story, that story was first told in the North Church in Danvers, Connecticut, where the Sons of the American Revolution used to meet in Danvers, Connecticut, and frankly, where they still meet every year on the anniversary of the shot heard around the world. And it was 50 years later in 1893 when Mellon Chamberlain first told that story in public. And this is how we know it was written down when he told it in that church in 1893. The funniest thing about the story, as an aside, is he opened the story by attacking the media. I mean, it's funny how no matter how things change, they stay the same, right? And if you think of the media in 1893, the only thing the media was the paper. That was it. The newspapers were the media. Most papers were printed in the evening, called the evening press. And so in most towns, you'd get your evening press. The funny thing about the evening press, think of these towns were pretty small, most of these towns, right? Even what we think of as a big city now, nothing like that. A big city was what we would consider a very small town. So by the time the evening press comes, all the news is out. It's at the local pub. It's been told at the blacksmith shop, the barber shop, the general store. And so when Chamberlain tells the story, he opens by saying, I have a story for you that I collected some 50 years ago. I trust it will be early enough for the evening press. You can look that up online. Just put in Mellon Chamberlain and Levi Preston. You'll find the whole story online. Great story. There's a reason that I opened by telling you that story. Because Levi Preston was a regular American, not one of these famous guys, not a great military leader, not a great business leader, not a rich guy, not landed gentry of some kind. He was just a regular guy. I mean, when I look at American history, and I read a lot of American history still, I look at those people and I wonder, well, where do I fit into all of this, right? You read about Washington, the indispensable man. I could never fill those shoes. I can't imagine anybody thinking that they could fill those shoes. Or Patrick Henry, literally the greatest orator of the American Revolutionary period. Patrick Henry was such a great speaker. You know the Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech? All of you guys know that speech, right? So that speech, we don't actually know what he said, which is kind of weird. Patrick Henry never wrote his speeches down, so he literally never walked up with any notes. It was all extemporaneous speaking, and he was known to be such a good speaker that they would hire people to go listen to him speak and to take notes of what he said so that they could write his speeches down so they could publish them later. And on that particular speech, which was given in the Virginia House of Burgess, they had four men there who were tasked with writing down a speech. Two of them were inside, two of them were outside looking through the windows and taking notes. And at the end of that incredible speech, not one of them had taken any notes. They were so amazed and enthralled by what he was saying, they just put their pens down and listened. And so that speech, what we know of that speech, is actually a reconstruction of those four men made later after the speech was given. So you have all these people. I can't imagine being Patrick Henry. I mean, just the like world-class, literally historical orator. Or Madison, who seemed to know everything there was to know in all of human history about systems of government. Right? Or Jefferson, this incredibly learned man, lawyer, articulate, intelligent. I don't imagine being any of those people. It's hard to imagine filling any of those shoes. But for me, I can look at Levi Preston and think, a guy with a family who believed in governing himself because he always had, and he was willing to fight for that, yeah, I could be that. And I think all of you can be that, and you're here, frankly, because you are that already. And that makes you a great American hero. And that's an important point to start for me, because I think a lot of times we look at everything going on around us, we look at how bad things are in Washington, D.C., or maybe even in your own state legislature, and I think you said it, Kevin, already, like you might think, well, what can I do about any of that, right? Because I'm just one guy, and I'm one woman, and I'm just a regular person. And the reality is Levi Preston was a Minuteman who fought the American Revolution, and we're sitting here today because of men and women like Levi Preston, who in their moment, when their moment came, when it was time to decide whether they were going to be servants or free men and free women, they decided that they were going to lean into that moment, and they were going to be in the fight. And so for me, when I travel around and I get to be in a room with people like you, and it doesn't matter to me whether it's 5 or 5,000, I'm among patriots. And I know sometimes we don't think of ourselves that way, and I think that's a mistake. And I hope that when you go home tonight, one of the things you'll do is look in the mirror and see yourself standing in the shoes of Levi Preston as somebody who's willing to stand up and say, enough is enough. So Levi Preston had said something really interesting. He said that we had always governed ourselves and we always had. And that's a really interesting thing to say because that's not normal in human history, right? These people who were living there in the colonies were living in entirely unique circumstances. And when I first heard that story, one of the things that came to me was, well, why? Like, why does he think that? Where could that possibly have come from that just some simple farmer living in the colonies could have thought that he absolutely had the right to govern himself and that he could tell a monarch, you know, the divine right of kings, he could tell a monarch to go pound sand because he was going to govern himself. Where did that attitude come from? And I started to research American history prior to the American Revolution. And when I dug into that period in American history, what I found was not much. There's not a lot written about that period in American history. And I started to look at this whole time period from the Pilgrims and Jamestown, right? The original establishment of in the New World, all the way up to the American Revolution. And the first thing I noticed was I had no idea how long that time period was. Somebody asked me once, how long is it from Jamestown to the first shot of the American Revolution? And that file cabinet drawer in my head was completely empty. I have no idea how long that was. I thought, I don't know, 75 years, 100, I really don't know. I was just guessing. And I've since learned it's 158 years. It's a long time. Five generations, roughly. Five generations, almost no history books written about that period in American history because just nothing was going on, right? I mean, it's just kind of weird that there's just a blank spot in American history. So I tried to really dig into it. The guy that really turned me on to the best books of the era was Larry Arnn, President Larry Arnn of Hillsdale College. My daughter was a Hillsdale student. I got to ask him that question personally. I was sitting at a football game, believe it or not. Hillsdale College has a football team. And Patty and I were there for homecoming, and because we were donors to the university, we got to sit in the president's box with Larry Arnn, and I was kind of nervous. I mean, he's a genius, literally. He knows so much about the Constitution. And I remember I was actually sitting right next to him, and I really wanted to ask him this question so bad. It was like the middle of the first quarter, and I leaned over, just kind of a quiet moment, and I said, Dr. Arnn, he said, yes. And I said, I'm really fascinated about this period of history, and I described it to him. And I said, are there any books about that? And he looked at me and he goes, yes, and if you'll shut up until halftime, I'll tell you what they are. So I was appropriately put in my place. Larry has a fantastic sense of humor. I'm still not sure whether he was joking or not. But he turned me on to some books. If you're interested in that period in American history, I highly recommend a couple of authors. Bernard Baylin, B-A-I-L-Y-N, great historian on the era. And another one is Pauline Meyer, M-A-I-E-R. She was a history professor at MIT. Meyer wrote a book called Ratification, great book about the ratification of the Constitution. She wrote another book called The Old Revolutionaries, about the difference between the people who fought the war and the people who put together the Constitution. Different groups of people. I didn't realize that at first. Baylin, if you want to read one of his, it's called The Political Philosophy of America, or The Origins of American Political Philosophy. Kind of tells you where all this stuff comes from. So here's the short version of a very long story. For 158 years, the colonists were free to govern themselves. And that was not normal in the world, anywhere in the world. This was an era of empires, and the world had always been about empires, monarchies, and conquerors, and regular people did not govern themselves. It was just a completely foreign concept. It was unknown literally anywhere on the planet. And if you want to go to a time in history, I was literally just talking to the pastor here about this before I came in. If you want to go to a time in history when human beings governed themselves in the way that we do here in the United States of America, you have to go all the way back to judges in the Old Testament. And remember that the people chose judges from among themselves. That's called representative government, right? There was no king. Like, you go through all of history, you're going to find the king, the queen, the princes, the royalty. And then judges, you get these people just governing themselves, and we get that again here in the colonies in the New World. Benign neglect by the crown. So by the time you get to the time of Levi Preston, his father, his grandfather's great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, and so on down the line, had governed themselves. And the idea that somebody from overseas, a king, a monarch, royalty, could come in and just tell them what to do was completely foreign to them. And this is really important because this is your history. Because when you watch the news at night, when you watch them pass bills here in the Arizona legislature or at the federal government level, and they're telling you what you can do and what you can't do and what kind of car you can drive, and you got to wear a seatbelt and you got to have a helmet, and what kind of paint you can put on your house and what kind of fabric can be in your clothing. For God's sake, they tell you how much water your toilet can flush. And they're telling you all that stuff, and inside you're thinking, I don't like this. And I'm uncomfortable with this. I don't like the government telling me what to do. You may not even use these words, but you're thinking to yourself in some way, shape, or form inside, I'm a self-governing person. I can damn well take care of myself. And that's how we feel, right? And we all feel that. Well, this is unique. It's important for you to understand this. This is not true in any other country on earth. This is a unique experiment in government that we have here. And I would say a unique and God-ordained providential experiment in self-government here in the United States of America. That's inside of every one of you. The same thing that was inside Levi Preston. It is our birthright as people who were born here. It is our God-given right because God gave us free will. If you're not born here and you came here and you became a naturalized citizen, it is your right by adoption because you came here and you adopted that set of beliefs and that set of values. And this is the fundamental and underlying thing that makes America unique in how we govern ourselves. And I would add, and it's important, and we're in a house of worship, and you can't say everything that I've said without saying, and all of it comes from God. Without God, none of that stuff matters, right? It's not relevant, right? Yeah, you can applaud for that. I appreciate that. All glory to God. Did you? I totally agree with that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, our education system has... Yeah, I agree with you. The education system has been good, and it's an empowering history. It's not a victim history, which is very different than what kids are taught today. Okay, so I'm supposed to talk to you about Convention of States, but I want you to understand where I come from and why I believe in this so profoundly, because this is rooted in our history. Article 5 of the Constitution is the ultimate federalist part of the Constitution. Anybody in the room consider themselves a federalist? Raise your hand if you believe in federalism. Yeah. We are a country based on federalism. Federalism, by the way, is a system of governance designed for people who hate each other. For real. Right? Look, when the colonies got together and they fought against the king, they didn't like each other. But they were facing an existential threat. So they got together, joined forces, fought the king, and then they went back to their own colonies, or then their own states, under the Articles of Confederation, which were a government designed for people who really, really hate each other, gave no power to a central federal government, so it didn't work. It didn't work as a union at all. So they come back together in 1787. They get together in Independence Hall, right? And you guys have seen me and Rick Green do some of the videos in Independence Hall, and they sit in that hall, and the good news about what happened in 1787 is they all got together in that hall, they boarded up the windows, you know the story, everybody was very cordial, right? And they all loved each other. Nobody argued, right? It didn't almost break up multiple, no, they hated each other. They were so frustrated, there was interpersonal rivalry, there were insults slung at each other. Big colonies against, or states against small states, slave against free, industrial versus agricultural, the big city states versus the rural states. They really didn't like each other. And out of that, what comes is federalism. Because federalism really is designed for people who can't get along, who don't really like each other, but who acknowledge that there are existential threats and existential reasons that cause them to have to work together on a limited number of things. And so out of that, what we got is this system of federalism, which reserves a limited number of things to the federal government. At that point, it was 17 enumerated powers to the federal government, everything else unenumerated and unlimited to the states and to the people, right? I mean, you guys know how that was structured. Here we are today, almost 250 years later, it's completely upside down. Essentially, the federal government has 17 million powers now. The states have very limited powers. The people have very limited powers. The system has been turned entirely upside down. But we are incredibly blessed because in 1787, in convention, on September 15th, by the way, in my opinion, the most important day in American history. I know people would say 4th of July or some war, whatever their anniversary. September 15th is my wife Patty's birthday. She's sitting right there. So if I ever forget that, I'm in so much trouble. So it's the most important day in American history. It's also the day in 1787, 2 days before the end of a convention, when Colonel George Mason stands up and he's in front of all these guys. He said the third most of anybody there, so they're probably tired of hearing him talk. He's an anti-federalist, so he's kind of a thorn in their sides. And he says, look, we have a big problem with this document. We've given the power to Congress to propose amendments, but we didn't give the same power to the people acting through the states. And he asks a question, are we so naive, are we so foolish that we believe that a federal government that becomes a tyranny will ever propose amendments to restrain its own tyranny? Now, and I hear that somebody always laughs when I say that. I'm sure they laughed. Right? Because no tyrant, have you ever heard anywhere in history, in any story, or in any reality, where a tyrant woke up one morning and thought, I have too much power, I need to give some of it back to the people. Right? That's never happened in human history. So when Mason says this to everybody assembled, everybody just nods. And we don't have videotape of that convention, so we don't know exactly what happened, but we have Madison's notes, which say at that point two short Latin words, nin com, abbreviations, which mean no comment. There's no debate. I mean, this is incredible. These men debated everything. They debated how to debate, right? And they fought about everything. And in that moment, Mason says the thing that's so obvious to everybody. It's such an epiphany that everybody just goes, oh, how did we not think of that? I actually imagine that they laughed. It was so obvious to everybody that they then put in another part of Article 5, the second clause, that says when two-thirds of the states want to gather in convention, they can apply for that convention and gather and propose amendments. And then that is adopted unanimously. That's the only thing I'm aware of, by the way, in the Constitution where there's no debate and it's unanimously adopted. So they were pretty darn sure that we were going to need to do this thing. And here we are 247 years later and we haven't done it yet. Sometimes I imagine myself sitting in an ale house in Boston and Ben Franklin sitting across from me. He's one of my favorite founding fathers because he was just kind of cantankerous and so interesting and worldly. That was a guy who probably knew everything there was to know. I mean, you can't know everything now. Back then, he probably knew virtually all of the compendium of human knowledge at the time. Super smart guy. And imagine sitting there and I'm complaining to Ben Franklin. I'm saying, you know, Dr. Franklin, it's so frustrating because, you know, they make us buy insurance, whether we want it or not. They tell us what kind of cars we can drive. They tell us how our houses have to be built. They tell us how we can use our own land and the resources on our land. They tell us where and when we can hunt. We have to buy hunting permits to go out and kill deer that we want to eat. And I imagine Franklin saying, whoa, hold on a second. What? Like, where do you live? First of all, like, what country is this? And then I imagine him saying, well, if you're having a problem with the government and they're this out of control and they're not responding to you anymore, what happened when you used Article 5 and called a convention of states? And I imagine sitting there embarrassed and saying to Dr. Franklin, we haven't done that yet. And he would say, why not? And I would say, well, you know, I mean, there's some people are kind of scared. You know, like people say they're worried about like actually calling a convention. And he would say, wait, do you understand what a convention of states is? It's where the states gather in their sovereign capacity and they debate the important issues of the day and they figure out how they're going to restrain a federal tyranny. I would say, yeah, Dr. Franklin, I understand. Why are people afraid of that? And I would say, I don't know. And I imagine Franklin slamming down his pewter mug of ale and the ale spilling on the table and saying, I'll have no more of this. If you want to speak to me again, come find me. Come call on me after you call a convention of states and you let me know how it went. And this is where we find ourselves in American history right now today. Everybody in this room, everybody you know who calls themselves a conservative or a Republican or a libertarian or a federalist or any of these descriptive terms, every single one of those people, 100% of them will tell you Washington, D.C. is out of control. And I don't mean 99 and 9/10%. I mean 100% of people will tell you that. And when you ask them what you should do, What should we do about that? Many of them will just give you that kind of deer in the headlights look. Right? They have no idea what to do. Some of them will tell you, and I hear this all the time, and God bless them for saying it, and I agree with this a little bit. We need to elect good people into Washington, D.C., into our state legislatures. But specifically, we need to send good people to Washington, D.C. And I say to that, hallelujah, absolutely, amen. It's a base duty of a citizen to elect the best people we possibly can. And so we're going to do that. We keep doing that. And then I ask, and how's that working for you? I'm 62 years old. My first vote of my lifetime was for Ronald Reagan. I've been trying to elect good people my entire lifetime. I've been doing this professionally for 15 years. I was one of the guys that helped found the Tea Party movement, the biggest turnover wave in Congress since 1938. How'd that work for us? Nothing changed. And so if it's not elections, we got to do something. We can't just sit here and watch. We are Levi Prestons. We got to be willing to pick up our muskets, metaphorically speaking, and go into battle. Then what do we do? And I say, praise God that the framers were wise enough to give us a nonviolent method to reform the federal government, to rein it in. If you want to think of it more viscerally, to get our hands around the throat of the federal government and shove it back in the constitutional box. We have the power to do that. And the only question that we have to ask ourselves is, do we have the fortitude to do it? Are we worthy of walking in Levi Preston's footsteps? I think we are. I know enough of you all over the country to be inspired to absolutely believe that we're worthy of that legacy. I would say not the whole country, certainly not the country at large right now, certainly not our current government, but certainly you're worthy of that legacy. Probably you know lots of people who are worthy of that legacy, and I know a lot of them all across the country. So the question is, are we going to do it? Right now, 19 states have called for a convention of states. Somebody mentioned 20. I would argue we're at 20. Kansas actually passed, but there's a litigation that we have to do to deem it passed in Kansas. They have a funky thing in their constitution. Were you the one who said 20? Okay, so you're right, I'm going to say. And they have a constitutional provision in Kansas that says they need a two-thirds majority to call for a convention. That's unconstitutional under the Supremacy Clause. That's being litigated right now. So that'll take us to 20. North Carolina should make 21 here pretty shortly. I got some good news today. I don't even know if I've told you that, Patty. Yeah, you saw that. So we passed in the House already in North Carolina. Next is just getting over the hurdle in the Senate. We've been pushing on that for a few years, but I think we're going to get it done this year. That'll take us to 21. I think Ohio and Pennsylvania are still plausible this year. Those are year-round legislatures, potentially 22 and 23. So we are on our way to the magic number of 34. I want to talk a little bit about what happens in a state like Arizona that has already passed the Convention of States resolution. Kevin talked about this. This is important. We have to have a rear guard action all the time. People are going to try and rescind. That is going to happen. Our enemies are chasing us from behind all the time. They want to catch you guys sleeping. That's their goal. You're sleeping. The legislators don't know about you. They're going to scare the legislators into thinking they can't do this and they should be frightened and they should rescind this thing. So we do that. The other thing that our teams do all over the country, including here, is they engage in things like that are just normal electoral things, like poll watching, like going out and becoming a precinct chair. I actually participated in my first county convention, Republican Party convention, last weekend. I was terrified, by the way. I've never done this before. No idea what I was doing. But, you know, one of my grassroots leaders in Texas said, look, you talk about we should all do this thing. How about you do this thing? And so we're precinct chairs, we're precinct captains, we're committee men and women. We participate in our state conventions. We work on taking over the party and pushing them into the right direction. We go out, we're poll watchers, we're election judges, we're poll workers. We do get out the vote. All this stuff, Convention of States activists do it here and all over the country. We also work in the legislature on things other than Convention of States. You guys need better election integrity in Arizona, right? We got to get a better governor first, but you guys need better election integrity. Maybe we need to improve the legislature a little bit too also. And so as we do that, we'll push for that, and our folks will be pushing for election integrity bills so that we can clean up not just Maricopa County, but mainly Maricopa County, but all over the state and make sure that we have better, cleaner elections, good ballot integrity. We work on things like parent and family legislation, parental rights legislation, legislation keeping all this insanity out of schools, the gender ideology, the CRT stuff, pushing back against the ESG stuff at the corporate level, getting the state to take positions against this stuff. We work on all that stuff all across the country. If you're involved in Convention of States, you're involved in an army of 5.3 million people all over the country. Over 70,000 people have signed the petition here, right here in Arizona. And what we need out of you guys, if you're not already involved, is to be involved. I'm going to close with a quick story, and then I'm going to open it up for questions, and everything's on the table, whatever you want to ask. We don't screen these in advance. You don't have to write them down. You know, sometimes this is hard. I don't mean just for me. I mean for all of us, right? We're engaged in political fights, and politics is a game where, truthfully, you lose more than you win. Period. Like, wherever you're playing, you're going to lose more elections than you win. You're going to lose more legislative fights than you win. You know, I've been doing this now 10 years with Convention of States. I can't even count the number of losses in committees or in hearing rooms or in legislatures around the country. But one step at a time, you get a few people to sponsor you. You get a committee win. You get out of a committee. You get to the floor. You lose on the floor. Eventually, you pass on the floor. Eventually, you get it through the state. It takes time. It's really hard. And it's really frustrating. And we live in a microwave, immediate gratification society, right? Prime, like Amazon Prime, is now too slow. I want it same day. Right? Can I get it in a couple of hours? And so we have this tendency towards everything we do, and we want it now, and we want to always win. And I'm exactly the same as everybody else in that way. And so I experience all the same frustrations in politics, especially. You get a setback, you know, 2020 was a terrible setback. 2022, we thought we were going to have some great red wave that never came. And then you got to get back up and you got to keep going. So there's a story that really reminds me what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And it's the story of John Quincy Adams. And John Quincy Adams, sixth president of the United States, he was a one-term president. And so not a very successful president, not very noteworthy really as president. But the most interesting thing about John Quincy Adams was after he was president, he ran for the House of Representatives. And it's hard for me to even imagine somebody doing that. Like, imagine Barack Obama being a backbencher in the House of Representatives. Well, I can't imagine Barack Obama doing almost anything that's good, so let's put him aside. But even, you know, imagine running the country into the ground. He was very good at that. You know, but even a Ronald Reagan, right, or George Bush deciding they're going to go run for the House of Representatives after they were president. So John Quincy Adams does this. He does it for one reason only, which is he's an abolitionist. And deep in his heart and deep in his soul, he knows what's right, and he knows that this is a stain on our great country, and he's going to do everything he can to try and erase that stain. So he goes to Congress, and at the time he goes to Congress, nobody's interested in abolition. I mean, he's alone on the issue. And it's all he wants to talk about. It's all he wants to debate. Every bill he ever brings up is about abolition. He doesn't serve in any leadership capacity because nobody really wants to listen to anything John Adams has to say at that point. And he does that for 17 years. This is absolutely incredible. I mean, the stamina to be able to do that and fight that fight, a losing fight for 17 years with no progress, literally. At some point, they find him so irritating in Congress, they pass something akin to the John Quincy Adams Censure Act, which says that if he talks about abolition on the floor again, that they will hold a 5-day censure trial, and they will censure him in Congress. His colleagues will censure him. And Adams thinks, you know what, that's an awesome idea. I would get 5 days to talk about abolition. So he does it. So you can tell he's a pretty difficult guy, right? He's very cantankerous. And towards the end of his career, a journalist asks him, kind of, what's your problem? Like, why do you keep doing this, right? Like, this is just, you're not going to get abolition. Nobody wants to talk about abolition. You're not interesting. The journalists don't care about you. Nobody wants to hang out with you. And John Quincy Adams gives the simplest, most beautiful answer, and it's really become a calling card for my own life. He says, duty is ours. Results belong to God. These guys over here, they're Patriot Academy coaches, so they know this story. This is one I did learn from Rick. Duty is ours, results belong to God. And so that means when we go out and fight, whatever we're going to do, whether it's Convention of States, or you're going to run for office, or you're going to work on a campaign, or support candidates, it's not the winning That's not your job. Your job is not to win. You're not in control of the outcome. You can't make anybody else do what you want them to do. You don't control what a legislature does. You don't control the outcome of any election. You do control what you do. You control whether you do your duty. And duty is a very underappreciated idea in American society today. I think people who join the military actually understand the concept of duty. First responders probably understand the concept of duty. Most people in American society have no idea what it means when you say, what's your duty? You know, duty is that thing that you do when nobody's looking, right? Because you know it's right, and so you just do it because you believe it's your duty to do the right thing. Duty, sometimes when you do your duty, it's painful. You don't want to do it. You'd really rather not do it, but you do it because it's your duty. Sometimes it has a financial cost to you. Sometimes it has a personal cost. Doing your duty might cost you your job because you do the right thing because you know it's your duty, but it's that thing that you do. And Quincy Adams understood this just as well as anybody I've ever seen in my life. He died on the floor of the House of Representatives. He actually had a stroke. If you go to the Capitol right now, in the rotunda, used to be part of the House of Representatives, there's a small plaque on the floor in Statuary Hall where it says John Quincy Adams fell here, right? And he actually died in what's now the women's cloakroom, but there's a memorial there to him. When he died, he had failed. He was a failure. And we still had slavery. We were nowhere near ending slavery. There was no pending abolition bill in the House of Representatives, which they could call the John Quincy Adams abolition bill. He was a failure. I don't believe that John Quincy Adams believed he was a failure. I think when he went home to meet his maker, he got a well-done, good and faithful servant, and the pat on the head that we all hope that we'll get when we go home and we face the judgment seat. And he knew he did his duty all the way to the very end. As Paul said, he ran the whole race, right? And I think that's a beautiful thing. But something happened during his last term as a congressman. And he met a young congressman who was very enamored with the fact that John Quincy Adams, the former president, was in Congress. Imagine, like, you're a brand new young congressman, and now you're sitting next to John Quincy Adams in Congress. What an incredible opportunity. And this young congressman took that opportunity and befriended John Quincy Adams and was mentored by John Quincy Adams and tried to learn everything he possibly could from John Quincy Adams. He learned Adams's three-part plan for abolition. He studied with him. He debated with him. He hung out with him. In fact, they became such close friends that after Adams died, he was asked to be one of the pallbearers at John Quincy Adams' funeral. Incredible honor, former president, first-term congressman, gets to be one of the pallbearers. That congressman then, at the end of his term, wanted to run for a second term. Back then, there was no such thing as a primary, by the way. The party told you who was going to run and who wasn't going to run, and you ran as a slate. And his party told him, you're not running again. You're coming home. We got another guy that we want to send to Washington, D.C. So he didn't run the next time. He asked again. And they let him run a couple of years later, and he lost. So he did not win office that time. And he ran again, by the way, and lost again. I mean, incredible story of just losing and losing. We've seen a lot of politicians do this. The third time he ran, he did win. And he won, and you know him as the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln. And that story is so important because John Quincy Adams did his duty. And he didn't shoot for victory. He just did what he was supposed to do. He did what he knew he had to do. And in doing so, ultimately, he did achieve that victory. And I would say God gave him that victory because he put the right man in front of him at the right time and learned the right lessons, and who's the guy who ended slavery in the United States of America. So I hope that you will think about what your duty is and what do you owe to your country? What do you believe is the thing that you need to be doing when you don't feel like doing it? When it's a Tuesday night and you'd rather be somewhere else, but you came to a meeting to learn something and possibly get involved in a cause, and you think about what can I do for my country, like John Quincy Adams or Abraham Lincoln or all these people like Levi Preston, whose stories we don't even know, they did when the country was in need. The country is in need right now. The country needs you. Convention of States needs you. And you can absolutely make a difference. So I'm going to close with that, and then I'm going to open it up for questions. You guys feel free, as many questions as you want. I'll stick around however long you guys will have me. So thanks for having me tonight.